Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 13th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here with me in the RJI studio are Views regulars and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. The Watergate break-in occurred 40 years ago this coming Sunday. The principal players are reminiscing and warning about cutbacks in investigative reporting. The New York Times is defending its investigative reports on kill lists and cyber war as the White House pledges to probe the source of the story's leaks. The axe falls at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. We'll discuss how the paper handled the news and what distraught employees had to say. And some interesting ethical challenges made news this week involving hoaxes and conflicts of interest. We begin with the 40th anniversary of Watergate. As we all know, on June 17, 1972, employees of Richard Nixon's re-election campaign were caught trying to break into the offices of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate Hotel. Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, along with many others, detailed the crime and the cover-up. Their work helped force the resignation of the president and has been seen by many as a high watermark of 20th century journalism. Well, there are plenty of lessons, Lee, I'm sure, to be learned from Watergate over 40 years. What's one that you would draw?
I think that the one I actually encourage students to draw, because I still teach with the film and with the book, even to this day, is that there is nothing like shoe leather and persistence and checking out every single thing. You know, the movie glamorizes it, and it's a wonderful film and all the rest of that. But what the book does, and what the book does for students, is to give them some sense about nobody's going to hand this to you. I love the insights of, you mean this wasn't on the web? And of, you know, of people going by hand through phone books and going back and back and back to people. And that's still, for me, a teachable element of journalism.
What else, Charles, is still relevant from 40 years on with Watergate?
The fact that the cultivation of sources remains probably the most integral part of the journalistic enterprise, and that if you can't nurture and cultivate sources, you're not going to find anything out. That is, I mean, that's not rocket science, but nothing about that has changed. And all the technological wizardry in the world will not change that.
I wonder, you know, Lee, you brought up the internet, and it wasn't available then. It certainly is now, a much more polarized, fractured media landscape. I wonder if a president and his staff or campaign aides did something along the lines of what Nixon's did today, how we might be able to cover it. Would we have the same impact as the reporters did covering Watergate?
I don't know that as a profession we would have the same impact, but I mean, you don't have to go very far back in history. I mean, you know, Clinton with, you know, his impeachment process, there certainly have been lots of scandals in the 20th century. I mean, you know, governors have resigned. I mean, all sorts of things have happened. So I think that on the big stuff, the journalistic profession still functions occasionally as a pretty good watchdog.
What's your take on that, Charles? I mean, would it be as possible for the media to have as big an impact for good on society and government as we did during Watergate days?
No, I don't think, because we don't speak with one voice anymore. I mean, that was a world in which we didn't speak with one voice, but we spoke with unified voice. Now you would have MSNBC on the one hand, if it was this president, saying, you know, this is an entrapment. He's clearly innocent. At the same time, Fox would like have, I don't know, a hangman's noose waving in the background. So we're going to devolve into partisanship over everything. And now, that's not to say that that didn't happen then, because there was a lot of partisan acrimony over it. But they had the goods. I mean, that's the thing. They delivered the goods, and it was very difficult to argue with the evidence.
But one of the things about Watergate is that the Washington Post went it alone for a very long time. No, there wasn't another media organization, not the New York Times, not, you know, any network. The blogosphere didn't exist. But, I mean, this was a very lonely – I don't want to call it a crusade because I don't think in most ways they felt it was a crusade. But it was a very lonely effort for more than a year. And so in that sense, Charles, we weren't unified. We were just – some of us were just more out to lunch than others.
You know, I wonder, one of the easy lessons or the mantras that we hear coming out of Watergate today is, it's, quote, the cover-up is always worse than the crime. And I wonder if that's maybe not a little too simplistic and underplays the significant nature of the crime that Nixon was involved in.
Yeah, and the other great maxim is follow the money, right?
Right.
Which does make sense to a certain extent. But, I mean, if we look at our political landscape right now, you can follow the money. It's fairly easy to follow. What you can't do is do anything about the influence of said money. And so it's – a lot has changed about the political landscape that Watergate took place in. I'm also not sure – well, clearly nobody would be as brazen today about the illegality probably as that group. Bernstein was at a 40th anniversary thing the other day and said – you know, it's not like you can Google up secret fund and up comes this information. And in that instance, he's right. But, boy, there are a lot more people digging through a lot more stuff. Some of them journalists, but a lot of them opposition researchers and non-government organizations.
No, and hackers could probably do more damage than the plumbers unit did, you know, 40 years ago. Yeah, I wonder, too, Lee, if we haven't trivialized what Watergate is over the years by essentially attaching the word gate to every little scandal that comes along.
Yeah, that actually really does bother me, because not only do we do it, but now other countries are doing it, which just makes, you know, the whole thing even more bizarre. But I want to go back to something, because there are times when I think the cover-up, as awful as they are, is not worse than the crime. And one of the things that comes to me is Abu Ghraib, which I think there was a lot of effort to cover up. And the cover-up to me was not worse than what happened. The other thing about Watergate is that it picked on what for us has become the easier target, namely government. To me, if we were going to have a 21st century Watergate, I'm convinced it would be something in the financial industry. I'm just not sure how we'd go about getting that story, because the same set of laws do not apply.
Yeah. We've said many times on this show and elsewhere that an entire generation of journalists, ours, went into the profession largely because of Watergate, and maybe some of us went into journalism education for that reason too. I wonder if there's anything like that out there now, any kind of story we could cover, any event, anything that could inspire this generation of prospective journalists the way Watergate did ours.
Wow. I think it would be at a more local level, right? Yeah. I think the potential does exist at the local level for particularly young journalists to go out and make a huge difference in their own communities by covering public corruption, for example, the influence of entrenched interest against newcomers to town. You know, those age-old themes of American city government that often huge stories lie behind that. Now, they're not going to have the impact on a national level that Watergate had, but they might be equally important in people's backyards.
One of the things that I notice from our students is it's not a story, but if nothing else, it's a point of view of what is the impact of international things locally. And we have an awful lot of students who are very concerned with and want to spend their careers covering either international things, whether that's politics or culture or war or what have you, or bringing those international ideas and understandings back home and putting it in a local context. And I think, at least for me, I find them inspired by it, and I find them inspiring in some of what they do.
It was interesting this week that Woodward and Bernstein are weighing in on the latest Washington scandal du jour. This is, of course, the leaks at the heart of the New York Times stories about the Obama drone strike kill list and the administration's use of cyber warfare against Iran. Well, the president says that Republican charges made last week that the White House is responsible. They must have been the ones to leak the information are, quote, offensive. Nonetheless, the attorney general has appointed a couple of attorneys to investigate. And I guess I wonder, Charles, what you take on Woodward and Bernstein's advice. They say the press is not the problem here, and they warn against a witch hunt when it comes to the investigation of the leaks.
Yeah, I totally agree with them, not surprisingly. Leaks can be good, and often are, in fact. I mean, leaks remain an avenue for the safe, in many cases, safe disclosure of information that otherwise doesn't have a way to get out. And sometimes the disclosure of that information is in the national interest. In fact, it often is. Were we to begin that witch hunt on leakers, there's a lot of collateral damage. And the first victim in that collateral damage is leakers themselves, right? People who feel morally compelled to share things. Are some leakers politically motivated? Yes, absolutely. They're motivated by all sorts of things. But often leaks are very therapeutic to the system of governance because they keep people on their toes. They keep people honest. They expose wrongdoing that all the chain of command is sitting on.
While all that is, I mean, I think from our perspective, at least obviously true, don't we also have to worry, Lee, about the collateral damage these kinds of leaks can have to people who are providing us with intelligence information, compromising our attempt to stop another 9/11?
I think it's a complicated thing. There's a great book that was published about 20 years ago called Impact. It's the only systematic study of leaking that I've ever seen. And one of the conclusions that I think is really worth cogitating even to this day is the notion that sometimes information gets leaked because somebody wants to block it. Sometimes leaks result in the premature closing down of policy options because now everybody feels like they've got their back against the wall. Sometimes leaks are therapeutic, as Charles said. So leaking itself is complicated. I think it's a very accepted part of the political process. I think, especially in Washington, I think it would be naive to think anything else. But I mean, you can find it here in Columbia. We can find it in Jeff City. It's just a way that people do things without having to be sort of accountable in all the meanings of that word for providing information to someone else it might not feel appropriate.
A comment that seemed kind of curious to me, at least, Charles, it's no surprise that the president would say allegations that the White House leaked this are, you know, outrageous, you know, whatever. But the New York Times primary reporter on this piece, David Sanger, was asked about it. And he also said he thought that he was doubtful there were any of those leaks were politically motivated. That just seems a little odd to me. Of course they had to have been politically motivated to a certain extent.
To a certain extent, I think so. Or at least motivated to – I mean, and this is another alternative theory you don't see, but I think it is at play here, and it is to add context and understanding in the part of the world where we are sending unmanned aircraft and killing people. Right now, there is a really strong perception that we are doing so completely indiscriminately. What I think this story pushes back at is that notion, right? And it does so in parts of the world that we really want to send that message to. So political diplomatic, I think, is another angle.
No, but I mean, I think that's an important story. But I also think it's – you would have to imagine that the people who leaked the information to Sanger were pretty high up in the White House. And they were thinking about the political ramifications for the president when they did so.
This is part of the theater of leaks, though, is that someone in the administration close to the leak has to express very public outrage about the leak even as people continue to leak, right? I mean, it's been going – what I love about this one is the apoplectic response from the right about the selective release of classified information that furthers the public interest. Does that sound like somebody else who was president for 8 years and who did it more on a daily basis than any president in the history of the republic?
Right, and all of that is predictable, but it wasn't as predictable to me that the reporter himself would say, no political motivations in the leaks that people made.
Strange theorizing.
I was going to say, and I think it depends on what you mean. Okay, I'm going to sound like Bill Clinton here. I think it depends what you mean by political. If political equates with electoral, then I can see a reporter saying that because, in fact, it can be a back channel on the front page of the Washington Post. The first George W. Bush administration did that beautifully with Iraq and Iran. So the notion that if there's a domestic political agenda, I think that's one thing. If it's an alternative to brinksmanship or putting something in a secret pouch and sending them by diplomat. You know, it's sort of like hiding it in plain sight. That is political, but in an utterly different context than the sort of domestic thing that we tend to focus on.
Let's move on to our next story. 2 weeks after the news first broke, we told you about it 2 weeks ago, and as we did many others, the New Orleans Times-Picayune made it official yesterday. Employees were called in one-on-one. These are always terrible, these meetings. And they learned their fate. A third of the newspaper's staff and nearly half of those who work in the newsroom are going to be laid off at the end of September. Editor Jim Amos tried to put the cuts in perspective in a video posted on the paper's website.
This is a difficult week at our paper. We've had to let go of some wonderful employees. It is a painful transition. We will also be hiring to increase our coverage of areas we know are important to our readers. We will be creating a new company, NOLA Media Group, that will cover the news for both the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. All this will allow us to preserve what the readers of the Times-Picayune and the users of NOLA.com value, the largest and most experienced news gathering team in our community.
Reporter Katie Reckdahl, who was one of those who was being laid off, spoke to the local television station WWL about her reaction.
I guess I'm trying to figure out how I didn't fit into the new organization. I think they've torn apart an institution. I don't know. It's not about me, really. It's about who I'm seeing walk out that door crying. It's the end of news in New Orleans, I think.
The group that owns the Times-Picayune is also laying off 400 employees at three papers that it owns in Alabama. Well, we talked about this the past couple of weeks. The reasons, Lee, that the paper gave for these changes, going to 3 days a week, making a decisive shift toward digital, was because the economics of the print business just aren't working anymore. Their argument, as you heard the editor say, was that by going more online, they can still provide the same caliber of coverage, but there's an awful lot of skepticism, as we heard in that one reporter's voice.
I think I'm skeptical, too, in part because I haven't really seen an online product that has done what they hope to be able to do. And I think because the Times-Picayune has done a lot of really wonderful things. In fact, I think they got another national award for reporting just last week. So, you know, they've stepped up for their city and for what that whole area of the country stands for in a way that very few other institutions have. And I think there's a level of undefinable trust between a news organization that behaves that way and the community. And I think one of the things that this move jeopardizes in a really significant way is that trust and the breaking apart of that trust. I mean, if you're a citizen of New Orleans and you care about that community, why would you talk to somebody at this newspaper?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Charles, there is a good way for a news organization to cover itself in a circumstance like this. The Times-Picayune on the printed paper put the story on the front page, but the editor of the American Journalism Review really jumped on them and said they'd flunked because online they placed the story 11th on the site after a murder story, an obituary, some national news, a story about American Idol doing auditions in New Orleans. And you also saw, you could call it piling on, you could call it maybe just taking their responsibility, but reporters from public radio, commercial television, alternative press in New Orleans were all saying, we're going to have to step up because the Times-Picayune is letting the community down.
It's noteworthy to me in that when the Rocky went under in Denver, it was a unbelievable occasion for a whole lot of coverage. When Seattle, the Post-Intelligencer, went down, it was likewise a pretty cataclysmic event. The way this is being met by the industry as almost a fait accompli is maybe the most disturbing thing about it. The fact that the reaction is, well, yeah, it was bound to happen, right? Talked to a friend in Birmingham last week who was very worried about losing her job, ultimately didn't in this round. But her sense of the whole thing was, as angry as I am at management, I don't see what choice they had. And that's the most disturbing thing about it, is you can't even fault them at that level because they could not continue in the death spiral that they were in.
Yeah. Well, we had several stories this past week, Lee, that had some ready-made ethics lessons. I know you like to talk about those as our resident ethicist. So let's begin with this radio call that came into the Coast Guard in New Jersey Monday afternoon.
We have 3 deceased, 9 injured. We've had an explosion on board. That's why we're taking on water.
As we know now, that call was a hoax. The pleasure boat Blind Date was not sinking. In fact, it wasn't anywhere near the New Jersey shore. But before we found that out, the Coast Guard had to put up helicopters and ships. They searched for hours. NYPD and the fire department were preparing for casualties. And, of course, the news media was taking this notice from the Coast Guard and spreading it through Twitter and the traditional means all over the place. We found out eventually that it was apparently emanating from onshore, from a radio broadcast somewhere in southern New York or New Jersey, and they haven't arrested anybody yet, but we know it was a fake. So I guess the obvious question, Lee, is could the media have done anything any differently given that the hoax was being spread by the Coast Guard? It's kind of like Balloon Boy in Colorado when it was the sheriff's department that was telling us the kid was floating around in that thing.
I was going to say, as sad as I feel about this, honestly, I can't fault what the journalists did very much. I hope that they, when there is an arrest made, and I hope that happens soon, I hope they cover that as well. It reminded me nothing so much as we had that film at True False 3 or 4 years ago about the Yes Men Fix the World or something like that, where it was all hoaxes, but they were in some ways believable hoaxes. And at least the one about Bhopal hurt people. And there's not really a good way to hold anybody to account for that unless they can arrest somebody.
Was that an attempted humor? I mean, is that what that is?
I have, well, Blind Date. I mean, I have no idea.
Wow, did that not work?
Well, this one was, I mean, costly and problematic, but not as disturbing as some of the other hoaxes. There are many of these hoaxes perpetrated every year, and Nightline did a really interesting story on this last night where they quoted the law enforcement people as showing how now with the internet and some new technologies, it's possible for hoaxers to be much more able to cover their tracks. I mean, they can do things like masquerade their voice, generate a false telephone number when calling into 911. I mean, so it's and some of these hoaxes are really cruel. In fact, I think they've got a new name for it. It's trying to remember what it's called. It's called swatting, because they're basically, you know, basically using like SWAT tactics, calling people in on innocent people. Things like calls saying, you know, my dad is killing my mom, or things like this. And it's just really horrible how this technology is making it very difficult for law enforcement or the media to sort out the hoax.
Gosh, going to end up getting somebody killed.
Yeah. And I don't really know what the media can do about that. I mean, how do we catch up with an increasingly savvy bunch of hoaxers?
Particularly when you've got breaking news and you're on a scanner and the cops are headed somewhere, then you've got to be there.
Well, and the problem is it's very difficult to determine in those early minutes precisely what is happening. And the most authoritative source usually is either medical personnel or the cops. Those are the two places that come up on the scanner. And we believe them because we really don't have any choice. The cops, of course, have to take it seriously, because if they don't and it turns out to have been real, they're in deep trouble too.
Well, here's an ethics case. It's a little more cut and dried, Lee. This one involves a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Gina Chan. She had an illicit relationship with a U.S. government official in Iraq while she was reporting from there. His name is Brett McGurk. She didn't tell her editors about the relationship, and worse, she shared some of her stories with him before they were published. That's a violation of the Wall Street Journal's policy. She resigned yesterday. Interestingly enough, though, McGurk, who she's now married to, is going through Senate confirmation hearings to become the next ambassador to Iraq. And for all we know, she'll lose her job and he'll keep his.
I think maybe not, because this has gotten such interesting press, including the fact, okay, here's another leak. Someone leaked some of their emails to Twitter. And if you dig deep enough into the blog, you'll uncover some really what I would call titillating stories about what was actually in those emails. So, I mean, this is a pretty classic case of, if you're in this kind of conflict of interest, disclosure begins it, but getting out of the situation, and if that means leaving your employment, is really the only thing you can do. I doubt that he's going to get confirmed.
I wonder, Charles, about a much more prominent journalist who also admitted to a conflict of interest last week. This was Barbara Walters, of all people. She acknowledged that she tried to help a press advisor to the Syrian President Assad get an internship at CNN and later get admission into the International Affairs Program at Columbia University. Her name was Scheherazade Jafari. She'd helped Walters, and her father had. He was the ambassador for Syria to the United Nations, to get an exclusive interview last December with the president of Syria. Well, the ABC journalist apologized after, you know, she was caught, apologized for her actions. Jafari didn't get the job at CNN, but she did get admitted to the Columbia University graduate program. So I'm wondering, I guess, was Walter's action any less serious than that of the Wall Street Journal reporter who's losing her job as a result?
Yeah, I think it's less serious in that she did a personal favor. She did not go to bed with that individual. I mean, I think that distinction is pretty bright line for me. I think Barbara Walters probably a lapse of judgment and one that in retrospect she saw pretty quickly was wrong.
But do you really retrospect, though? I
mean,
come on. She should have known that at the
time. I don't think any of us can be entirely sure that she went, red flag, I'm crossing the Rubicon here. Whereas if a source who happens to be an incredibly high-ranking diplomatic official in Iraq asks you out and you start dating that individual, I think you knew you crossed the Rubicon over and over and over and over again.
The other thing that's different about what Barbara Walters did is that there were other checks and balances in place. I mean, we all know because we have the experience. You can recommend somebody for fill in the blank, a graduate program, a job, babysitting next door. The assumption is that the folks that you're making the recommendation to aren't going to just take your word for it, that they're going to do a little due diligence. And so I think that makes it very different. And at least in the case of CNN, apparently, for whatever reason, she was not hired. And as I sit here, I'm still not sure that she's not qualified to be in the program at Columbia. I mean, we've certainly educated folks in this country who were the children of powerful political elites for governments that we did not agree with at the deepest of levels. And I'm not sure that that's, quote, wrong.
Well, sure.
I suppose. But I would think if you even just look at the perception of conflict of interest, that someone as savvy as Barbara Walters would realize, she helped me get an interview with the president. A few months later, I'm trying to call in chits to get her into a prominent university program. I'd say there's at least a perception of conflict of interest there.
Well, and I'm doubting this is the first time Barbara's been involved in doing a favor for somebody to curry favor with a source, nor will she be the last journalist that does that.
Well, just bring up, as we're wrapping up the program, a couple of interesting viewing opportunities for you in the next week and a half. This Friday night, if you are so inclined, the ABC News Magazine 2020 will feature an exclusive interview with Riel Hunter. Yes, the former mistress of presidential candidate John Edwards and the mother of their daughter, Quinn. She's going to be on 2020 this Friday. I'm imagining that'll be about as sleazy as we're thinking it will be. And also a week from this Sunday, perhaps a bit more high-minded fare, HBO subscribers are going to get to see the pilot of Aaron Sorkin's latest drama called The Newsroom. Sorkin is best known for The West Wing, of course. His new show skewers cable TV news and American culture that lets us get away with less than aggressive reporting. Lee, I know you've been a big fan of Sorkin and The West Wing. Can he pull it off in trying to turn the gaze on reporting without making it boring?
I don't know if he can or not, but you would have thought The West Wing was boring, and he managed to make it anything but. I know he's had his issues, but I like The West Wing. I think he was one of the co-authors on The Social Network, a film that did, I don't want to say good, but certainly an interesting job on the invention of Facebook. I'm not an HBO subscriber, and I'm actually reconsidering that decision because of this.
Well, I'm afraid we've only scratched the surface. We'll have to watch the show, maybe. Maybe next week we'll talk about how well, or not next week, the week after next, how well it did. But that's going to have to wrap it up for this week. I'm going to give our normal thanks to Lee and Charles for their comments. We also want to thank our technical staff. That would be Travis McMillan with RJI and Pat Akers with KBIA. If you'd like to find out more information about our stories, you can go to our blog. Go to the KBIA.org tab that says talk shows and you'll find us there. We have related videos and links to articles and audio that you can check into. You can also leave your questions, comments, or story suggestions there or via email at views@KBIA.org. I'm Mike McKean. Please join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.